UK Wine Show, show number 183 for the 20th of November, 2009. Jamie Good on Roots and Grapes. Good day to you all and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and this week we're continuing our chat with Dr. Jamie Good about vine biology. Specifically, we're going to be talking to him about grapes and the roots this week. In the spotlight, we've at last finished our different book reviews. I do have loads of books to review and read yet. It seems that August through to October is a big time for every man and his dog to release yet another wine book. I've even got a copy of The Billionaire's Vinegar, which I ordered from Amazon.com. You may recall, it's the book about Michael Broadbent and a very old bottle of wine. Michael sued the authors in the UK and had it banned using the rather draconian English libel laws. The publication house buckled and removed the book from sale in the UK and stopped all subsequent print runs of it, anywhere in the world. Right, let's get straight into the show now. I don't want to have too much of a rant about that again. This week we're back to a normal spotlight. This time we're going to be looking at the second part of Alcohol and Wine. It seems so long ago that we looked at that. I think it was, what, 2 months ago, a month and a half ago? But this week we're going to be looking at the equipment for low-alcohol wine, and we're going to be looking at spinning cone method in particular, or the spinning cone column, as some people like to put it. But before we get into the news, we've got our first clue in our mystery grape this week. As normal, I'm going to give you two sets of clues and see if you can work out the mystery grape variety, and I'll give you the answers right at the very end, as well as reiterating the clues just to help you remember it for future reference. So here's our first clue on our mystery grape variety, which is a vigorous grape variety, high in acidity and often quite stringent, and it's an enjoying a revival in the south of France. It's most likely originated in Spain, where, although declining, it is the fourth most planted red grape variety and is known as Monstrel. With a warm climate, it adapts well to good range of soils and will ride out spring frosts. However, it doesn't like low winter temperatures and is susceptible to downy and powdery mildew, which are more common in France than in Spain. It buds and ripens very late, not a problem in Spain, but in France it needs the warmest of summers to reach full ripeness. That ends our mystery grape variety. Next up we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Majestic's half-year trading figures to September the 28th show its change in strategy to reduce minimum purchases to just 6 bottles instead of 12 seems to be paying off. Like-for-like sales increased by 5.4% and pre-tax profits were up by 9% to £6.1 million over the period. Sales to private customers continue to show strong growth, up 8.9%, while corporate customers had declined. The chain also reported a 25% growth in online sales. Majestic's chairman, Simon Burke, said the decision to allow 6-bottle purchases, which took effect from September the 1st, had produced encouraging results, and a small reduction in average spend had been more than offset by an increase in sales volumes.
We reported a while ago that Majestic had changed to 6 bottles, and it looks like the strategy's worked for them. But they're still in some hot water. What's going on there, Jane?
Wine writer Martin Isaac has issued a writ against Majestic Wine, claiming damages believed to be in the region of £50,000. The writ alleges that without permission, Majestic used a tasting note Isaac had written on the 2000 vintage of Cuvée de Richard Van de Pays de Lorde on the 2008 vintage which he'd never tasted. According to reports, the tasting note amounted to no more than 2 words, incredible value. The writer is suing Majestic for false endorsements and infringement of copyright.
Apparently, this is the third time he's taken legal action over alleged misuse of his tasting notes. In 2005, he sued Conte de Toro for using his tasting note without permission and on the wrong vintage. In another case, he took Direct Wines to court in 2008. Both were settled out of court. It would appear that Martin makes good money from suing people who use his notes, but copyright is copyright. To get an idea of how much money he wants if people use his tasting notes, on his website, I quote, and I hope I'm not going to get sued for quoting this, but he wants a starting point for a drink producer or mail order company, multiple or supermarket. He wants £15,000 plus 2% of all sales. Wow. And given his litigious nature, I'm sure it's been quite a profitable venture for him. That said, copyright is copyright, and taking these guys to court may make him some money, probably a bit more than he makes doing his wine writing. But I do think it's dodgy using a tasting note from a previous vintage on the current one. but at least he claims to enforce the tasting note to ensure that they are consistent, unlike some wine writers. What's next, Jane?
Well, Australian wine writer and sommelier Matt Skinner has admitted to not tasting several wines that he recommends in his latest book, The Juice 2010, after being criticised by New Zealand wine writer Michael Cooper. Cooper claimed that Skinner could not have recommended a New Zealand wine months ahead of publication before Cooper himself could have tasted it. In his book, Skinner lists New World wines from the 2009 vintage that were not bottled until months after the last deadline for the book. In a statement, Skinner said, "There are some releases that are consistent from year to year, and as popular, good value, accessible wines, I want to include them because I know that my readers will appreciate them. In order to do so, I include non-specific tasting notes based on the current and previous year's vintage, focusing more on basic flavours and compatibility with food." Matt's based in Melbourne and is group wine manager for Jamie Oliver's 15 restaurants. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to look out for these news stories on our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I know quite a few people have got a bit upset by this, and it is difficult to get a decent recommendation from wine books. In Matt's defence, he has to submit the books to the authors before the wines are released. If he recommended the previous vintages, it'd be out of date. You wouldn't be able to get the wine. Now, I'm not going to defend Matt, but let's face it. Many New World countries produce identical wines year on, year out. So vintage variability is less of an issue than perhaps maybe some of the old world countries. But the question is, if the wines don't change from year to year, why does his book come out every year as an annual book? Perhaps he should just issue one and hope that it stays consistent for a couple of years. I must admit, I've told people to try wine, not because I've tried the current vintage, but because I know the producer and I know they produce great, consistent wines. I can easily rattle off producers I recommend, and I may not necessarily have tried that particular wine or that particular vintage recently. I suppose the difference is I don't put it down on paper and I don't charge people for the advice. Oh well, perhaps you should get your wine recommendations off bloggers. I think they're at least more up to date. Right, that pretty much finishes the news. Next up, we've got the spotlight. And this week's spotlight, we're looking at the different ways alcohol can be reduced. If you recall a wee while ago, we were looking at low alcohol wines. It seems like so long ago that we were looking at low alcohol wines. I will put the notes up on this onto our website under low alcohol wines under the UK Wine Show. So you can get the notes from the previous article on low alcohol wines. This week, we're going to be looking at spinning cones as a method of reducing the alcohol in wines. Spinning cone is a form of steam distillation to extract volatile chemicals such as alcohol and flavours from wine and other foodstuffs while minimising its effect on the taste of the product. To visualise it, imagine a tall round cylinder. Inside are a series of upside down cones connected to a central shaft that's spinning round and round and round. Between the spinning cones are another set of cones, and these are connected to the stationary outside wall. The liquid comes in at the top and through centrifugal force pushes the liquid up the cone towards the outside wall. The spinning spreads the liquid evenly and creates a large surface area, which is quite important. Once the liquid reaches the tip of the cone near the stationary wall, but not connected to the stationary wall, it flows over the side onto a stationary cone connected to the wall and then slides down due to gravity. Near the bottom, it drips off the stationary cone connected to the wall back onto a spinning cone which is connected to the central shaft. Once again, centrifugal force pushes the liquid up and out again. This process is repeated a number of times, hence it's called spinning cone because it has lots of spinning cones interlaced with stationary cones. While this is occurring, steam or another solvent enters the bottom and winds itself up between the cones, eventually coming out the top. As it rises through the cones, it picks up volatile aromas and or alcohol. The steam containing the flavours and alcohol are then taken away. In California, where there's over 200 spinning cone columns are in operation to remove alcohol, it's a two-step process. Firstly, a portion of the wine is treated separately and passed through the spinning cone column to remove delicate aromas of the wine. These are saved and put aside. Then, the same wine that had the delicate aromas is passed through again, this time stripping the alcohol. The de-alkalized wine and the flavour from the first pass are then blended back together and added to a proportion of the untreated wine, giving the finished wine with a lower alcohol but no flavour loss. Other methods of alcohol reduction, such as evaporation or filtration, cause a loss of many vital flavour compounds and require a far greater volume of wine to be processed. So the spinning cone does have some advantages. And the key advantages is the fact that it's fast. It normally takes less than 20 seconds for the wine inside the spinning cone to go through. As a result, it gets very little thermal damage to the wine. Also, because of its highly efficient, only around 20% of the wine needs to be processed to reduce the alcohol levels by about 1 degree alcohol. So that is how the spinning cone works. I do have some pictures on the website, so if you'd want to have a look at how it works, go to our website 3050.co.uk, click on podcast, and you'll get to our podcast section. And on the left-hand side, there's a section called Low Alcohol Wines near the bottom, and you can see this article as well as some pictures about how it works. It's quite hard to imagine visualizing. It took me a while to work it out. But that finishes the spotlight. But next up, we have our mystery grape. Let's have the last of our two clues. In Spain, the grape is grown particularly in Alicante and Valencia, as well as Levante, where the resulting wine tends to be high in tannins and alcohol, with gamey flavours and youth. But it can age too. In southern France, throughout the Languedoc and the Roussillon, as well as in Provence and the southern Rhone, it's often used to add structure and makes wine with intense fruit and aromas of blackberries in good years. Okay, that's our last clue on the mystery grape variety. I will give you the answer after our interview, which is coming up next. As I said earlier, we're talking with Jamie Good, and this week we're talking about grapes and roots. Let's have a listen to what Jamie has to say about them. Hi, I'm here with Jamie Good and his friendly dog, Rosie. Well, she's down there asleep. We're going to be talking a wee bit about how grapes ripen and that sort of process going on there. I think last week when we were talking about the various things, we were talking about how the leaves are the source of sugars and the grapes are the sink, so to speak, of the sugars, and they also produce their own flavours. Have I got it right there?
No, that's right, Chris. Yeah, you're on the right lines there. That's how you were listening.
Yeah, just. just trying to keep up with you, Jamie. Yeah. Just trying to keep up. So you were saying that a lot of the flavour compounds are produced inside the grapes, and we talked about Argentina, where they've got high UV lights, for example, that can increase the amount of flavonoids produced in the grapes.
Well, I guess what you've got with the grapes you're looking at flavour compounds that, say, for instance, let's look at Sauvignon Blanc. You've got flavour compounds produced in the grapes that then go all the way through fermentation process and remain in the wine. Yep. For instance, like methoxypyrazines.
Yeah.
You know, give you that green pepper character.
Yeah.
The methoxypyrazine is quite interesting because they're produced by the grapes, and they're kind of like herbaceous, grassy, green pepper characters that, in strong concentrations, they're actually quite unpleasant. And these are kind of one of the compounds that sort of act as an antifeedant to kind of put birds off until the grapes are properly ripe. And so the methoxypyrazine levels dip towards true ripeness. But in Sauvignon Blanc, we quite like a little bit of methoxypyrazine in there.
Yeah.
And this methoxypyrazine survives the whole fermentation process, and it ends up in the wine. Whereas, for instance, with one of the other important flavor compounds in Sauvignon Blanc are the thiols. They give you the kind of this passion fruit sort of character.
Yeah.
Thiols are sulfur-containing compounds.
Yep.
And what you get in the grapes is you get precursors of these thiol compounds. And then it's the yeast during fermentation that convert these precursors into the thiols that, you know, in Sauvignon Blanc can be quite positive.
Is that the same for all grapes?
Well, it's interesting, yes. I think with the flavour compounds, you've got a mix of flavours in the grapes at harvest that will then carry through to the finished wine. Uh-huh. And you've also got flavour compound precursors in the grapes, which the yeast then use to, depending on the yeast strain and depending on the fermentation conditions, will convert into the flavour compounds that we get in the wine. So it's a kind of a mixture, really. It's a very complex business, this whole area of flavour chemistry.
Yeah.
But what viticulturists are trying to do is to get grapes that have, you know, the potential to produce really interesting, complex wines.
What about secondary aromas as well?
Because
they're obviously using some of the aromas that are already in the wine. Mm. But I presume as those components break down over time, because they're just organic and they will react and break down over time, are they pulling in other molecules as well? Or and how come some wines do seem to develop interesting bouquets, but others don't?
That's an interesting point. And I think there's a lot. This is one of these areas where we kind of know a little bit and we can guess, but we don't have that many good data on this. But what would be really interesting would be to kind of pick a bunch of grapes from, say, like the Romani Conti vineyard, and then compare that. compare that with a bunch of grapes picked from a village level vineyard in Burgundy, and then pick a bunch of grapes from, just a generic Bourgogne vineyard, and to get those grapes on the table, and to see how much of a difference you can taste between them.
Yeah,
I think it'd be quite fun. Because ultimately what we're looking to do is with viticulture, is we're looking to really just get the vine in that right place that it's producing fruit that has all the potential to make great wines. And there's a mystery involved with that. And then we enter this whole area of terroir, which is fascinating. And what is it about certain sites that makes them so special? And how is it that the grape producing the potential for fantastic wines, what's the connection between the soil and the grape? And I think some of the French people, the French vignerons have this notion that the grape is actually pulling out flavor compounds from the soil.
Exactly.
Le goût de terroir,
Yep.
And so I find it fascinating as a plant biologist, or albeit a slightly lapsed plant biologist, to then try and think, what is it? How can we frame this in more scientific terms? And the reason I think that's really interesting is because wouldn't it be fun, through our knowledge of plant biology, geology, all the interactions between the site and the vine, to replicate these fantastic terroirs, or to have a better understanding of just how we can make fantastic wines by getting the right sites? What is it about sites that make them special?
Are you saying there is a mechanism for extracting other than just organic ions from the soil?
No, I don't think there is. You're planting a grapevine in flinty soil and you end up with a wine that tastes flinty. That's a very interesting and seductive idea, to think that the vine is taking up flavor compounds from the soil and putting them into the grapes, and then they end up in the wine. I don't think it really happens. I think it just happens that there is a bit of reduction there, maybe, and it's a very fresh, high acid sort of style. It tastes flinty.
Let's talk a wee bit about the roots a wee bit.
Roots are very interesting. Yeah,
yeah. A lot of people talk about the vine, but the roots are quite interesting. I was reading that most of the root ball is actually just in the top couple of feet of soil, in the humus, and that's where it can actually get access to those organic ions we were talking about.
Yeah.
Why do people talk about the roots needing to go deep into the ground to get all the minerals from further down?
Yeah, I think it's probably to some degree a sort of emotional association. We like to think of the vine extracting something deep from the soil and then going to the wine.
Yeah.
The vine roots, if you have a dig them up, you'll see they're kind of pretty tough, compare them with other roots. The vine roots are specialized for is that, a vine in its native environment is, in a woodland, is kind of coming along after all the other plants are established. So what the vine root has to be able to do is it has to be able to compete with all these other roots. And often that will mean going further down than the other roots to get good water supply. So, vine roots do go down a long way, and they can go down incredible distances. But most of the vine roots will do their business close to the soil surface, and certainly in a vineyard where there's good nutrient availability, most of that will be in the topsoil.
Is there an advantage with the vine going down? Is it only going down to get access to water?
It will mostly get water from deeper down, but it might also get some inorganic ions as well.
I heard it was quite hard for vines to synthesize or absorb those organic ions if it's not already sort of pre-absorbed by a plant and broken down again. Is that true?
I think there's a whole business of nutrient availability, and the soil microbiology is going to have a role here. I mean, you can grow vines hydroponically. Some people say the gimblet gravels in New Zealand is kind of hydroponics, because it's this gravelly layers and there's not much there. You need to irrigate, and it's like they call it hydroponics, and which upsets the growers there. But the soil microbiology is going to have an effect on the nutrient availability, because it's going to be more complex and more regulated when there's an active, healthy microbial population around in the soil. I don't really know if anyone's studied this massively well. Biology isn't as simple as people think sometimes. There's all these interactions between a whole roster of organisms that live in the soil.
But most of them are at the surface.
Yeah, it's going to be much more at the surface. You know, I think that the reason why people like deep roots, you know, the idea of ploughing up the superficial roots means the vines have to go down deeper, is that basically that this seems to be so crucial for grape quality that you have a slow, steady supply of water, which then tails off gradually towards veraison. And this seems to be the sort of terroir characteristic that is shared by many of the great vineyard sites. They have different soils, different soil chemistry, but it's that water availability issue and the timing of water availability that seems to be so positive for improving grape quality. And this is one of the reasons why there's this whole interest in the area of precision root drying and regulated deficit irrigation, which are ways of timing your water additions to the soil that first of all help the vine produce good quality fruit through signaling largely by a plant hormone called abscisic acid. And, you know, the water availability can actually help that signaling so that the vine concentrates on fruit production.
Oh, it's saying, okay. Yep.
And also that these technologies save a lot of water. Yeah. And water availability is a big issue in lots of countries now.
Particularly Australia at the moment.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interest in these technologies.
So to summarise, you think that the plant driving down deep is just going down mainly for water?
Yeah,
Highly unlikely to be pulling much out of there.
Well, it might pull something out, yeah. But it's the most of the nutrient availability will be at the higher layers of the soil, yeah.
Okay, and I suppose in places like Europe where you're not allowed to irrigate, getting the roots deep is important so it can survive droughts or have more consistent supply of water.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, whereas in countries like Chile or Argentina where irrigation isn't really a problem, is it so much of an issue?
Well, I think then what becomes an issue is how you manage your irrigation. And that's then a critical quality parameter in terms of viticulture.
Yeah.
In terms of timing your irrigation, so that you're not just pumping up, you know, for huge yields, but you're actually looking for quality as well.
How does the root actually absorb nutrients, the organic ions? Because I always think of roots almost like the leaves of a tree. You know, they got bigger roots and then they get finer and then they get finer and then they get finer.
That's the way roots grow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the very fine root hairs and that do the business of absorbing.
How do they do that? Do they?
Because they have a huge surface area, because they're very fine, so they have a huge surface area.
Yep.
And you have this osmotic potential where the concentration of solutes, that's dissolved things, in the root cells is higher than outside. So the water flow by osmosis is inwards into the roots.
Uh-huh. And that takes, is there organic ions dissolved in that water?
There will be as well, yeah. There'll be some inorganic ions dissolved in that water. But the plant can also absorb inorganic ions against a concentration gradient through special pumps, some iron pumps that it costs energy.
Yeah.
But the plant can use that energy to absorb, say, for instance, nutrients it particularly needs against a concentration gradient.
Can it choose what nutrients it pumps in?
Yeah. Yeah, these pumps are selective pumps.
So if it's short of magnesium, it just works a bit harder to get that magnesium on board.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of putting it. Yeah, in reality, it's kind of a bit more complex, like all this biology. It's frustratingly complex, but that's kind of what keeps it fun.
Okay, and how does the plant know that it's short of magnesium? How does it signal?
That's a good point. I don't exactly know how it must be some sort of...
Humans, we have, what is it, you've got loads of chemicals all around our body, hormones, signaling, all things all the time. Does plants have hormones signaling things?
Plants do all sorts of signaling. I mean, what they've got to do is they've got to find a way of coordinating in terms of the development and also the behavior of the plant, behavior across long distances. And the way that they do that, they don't have a nervous system like we do.
Yeah.
So the way they do that
they
is, but
do.
No, don't have a nervous system.
Yeah. Maybe the triffids have, not great.
So what they do is they use a whole range of chemical signals, and obviously the most famous long range signals that the plant uses are the plant hormones, of which there are several different types. But they use other chemicals as well, and so the plant can communicate with itself, and you know that's a There's some interesting stuff with plants, you know, the way that they can even communicate with each other sometimes by using airborne signaling.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So one plant can be, say, attacked by a certain pathogen, and the plant can release airborne signals, then communicate with other plants nearby.
Interesting. I suppose
it's pretty crazy stuff, but it does happen.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose is that because they're biologically very similar? They might be mother daughter or from a similar plant.
No, it's just like this. I think salicylic acid is one of the communication methods. And the other one other thing is that plants do that is really, really fascinating, which is they release chemicals when they're attacked by particular organisms, volatile chemicals.
Yep.
Say, for instance, you've got a particular bug munching on your leaves, a caterpillar. The plant will release these semiochemicals, they're called sign chemicals. And then, say, for instance, a parasitic wasp that parasitizes the caterpillar that's attacking you is recruited. You see it detects a signal, and then it comes and eats the caterpillar or parasitizes it, you know, lays eggs in it and that sort of thing. So the plants do this kind of interesting signaling, you know.
Okay. All right, then, Jamie, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Okay, that ends our interview. I hope you enjoyed that. We've got one more interview with Jamie. He's still looking at the biology of wine, so do stay tuned for that next week. But next up, we have our answer to our mystery grape variety. If you're not sure what it is, it was Mourvèdre. Here's the clues again. Mourvèdre is a vigorous red grape variety, high in acidity and often astringent, that is enjoying a revival in the south of France. It's most likely originated in Spain, where, although declining, it is the fourth most planted red wine grape variety, and it's known as Monstrel. With a warm climate, Mourvèdre adopts well to a good range of soils and will ride out spring frosts. However, it doesn't like low winter temperature and is susceptible to downy mildew and powdery mildew, which are more common in much of France than Spain. It buds and ripens very late, not a problem in Spain, but in France it needs the warmest of summers to reach full ripeness. As Monstrel, the grape is grown particularly in Alicante, Valencia and Levante, where the resulting wines tend to be high in tannins and alcohol, with a gamey flavour in youth, but they can also age well too. In southern France, throughout the Languedoc and Roussillon, as well as in Provence and southern Rhone, Mourvèdre is often used for its structure and makes wine with intense fruit and aroma of blackberries in a good year. Okay, we're almost finished for this week's show. I hope you're enjoying it. This week's quote was sent in from John Scrouse. So thanks, John. It was said by Juan Carlos Sancha from Rioja, and he said that there are about 8,000 grape varieties in the world, but just 10 of them account for 90% of production. Wine should have a geographic stamp. Otherwise, it's just Coca-Cola. Interesting thoughts. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.